You know, most people do not live according to the facts of reality. People live passionately and by their prejudices. We interpret facts always through the lens of myth, which means that we function under a series of illusions about the most important things of life. Let me read you the words of the famous American president uttered in 1962. The great enemy of truth is very often not the lie, deliberate, committed and dishonest, but the myth, persistent, persuasive and unrealistic. Too often we hold to the clichés of our forebears. We subject all facts to a prefabricated set of interpretations. We enjoy the comfort of opinion without the discomfort of thought. You ever wondered why most women would rather be beautiful than brainy? It's because men see better than they think. And that is an illustration of the fact that I am making. That we do not live according to the facts. We live life according to a series of myths or illusions. If we only understood this, we could abolish war. You know, war is a result of our greed and our prejudices. When I was staying in the YMCA in Korea, they had up a notice. There's only one race, humanity. There's only one nation, mankind. There's only one community, the world. But through the myth of prejudice, we are biased against a colour or a society or a tradition, and so we have war. I want to use a more trivial example today that is topical to show you how pervading this fact of living against the facts is. I want to talk to you about travel. The myth is that travelling is one blissful moment after another. The people that think that have never travelled. Or if they have, they haven't travelled much. I often think of Mark Twain's book, Innocents Abroad. I've travelled around the world, approximately the equivalent of around the world, 22 times. I've been to about 35 countries. But I'm just an innocent when I'm abroad. And while I pray much all the time, I pray twice as much when I'm travelling. It's a very perilous procedure. There are many people that have less trauma than I. I'm a bit absent-minded. But everybody has trauma. Just everybody. Let me tell you about the last 24 hours of my trip. It was an untroubled, happy time. I'm not being humorous. It was an untroubled, happy time. But nevertheless, this is what it meant to travel for the last 24 hours. Before dawn, I was listening to some material I'd put on cassette about Korea as to how to get out of Seoul and make sure I got to the airport. I've only ever taken one taxi in about 10 years that I can remember. I'm allergic to taxis, dollar-wise. I never go by taxi if I can go by bus. I never go by bus if I can go by foot. So I was listening to what I'd put on tape about how to get to the main airport. And it stressed that the two buses I could take was the official bus 105, an airport bus, or the local bus, which was a 601. But I thought, you've got to be sure. You've got to check up. So as I was paying out at the YMCA counter, I said, now which bus do I get to the international airport? Or they said, 605. And I said, I can get downstairs? Yes. Well, they didn't know much English. And so when I went downstairs, I thought I'd better check this out. There was a bus stop. They were right. As I looked at the numbers of the buses that stopped there, there was no 605. Now I was carrying my luggage, and I walked down to the preceding stop to see if other buses stopped there. Again, no 605. Went one further back, no 605. Went one ahead, no 605. So in the crowd that was milling around, I saw a young man. I thought, he ought to be learning English. He looks bright and intelligent and young. I said, do you know English? Shyly, he conceded that he knew a little. I said, which bus to the international airport? He found it a bit hard to tell me, so he said, follow me. So I got on the next bus, which was not a 605. And about a quarter of an hour later, it stopped, and he got out with me, bringing me in his train, and he went over to a little group of people, and he asked them a question, and they directed him, and he said to me, 67. We went a little further on, and he said, 68. I said, now, which is it? The travel book said 105 and 60 such and such, upstairs in the YMCA. They said such and such. Now he told me 607. Then he says 608. We stopped at the bus stop. He said 68. Then he said, and this will wow you, then he said 401. 401. 67, 68, 401. Which do I get? I can't get on three buses. And I want to arrive. And then it struck me. The unit of money in Korea is the one. And what he was telling me in 401 was how much to put in the slot for the expenses. So it was bus 68, his second estimate. And 401 wasn't the number of another bus. It was how much money I was to put in as I entered the bus. Well, I entered the bus that was headed for the international airport. And when it stopped, naturally I got out, took my luggage in and began to look for United. But there was no United. No United. I said to them, no United. Oh, no, they said, there's another terminal, another airport. You'll have to get the shuttle. So I got the shuttle, and when it stopped, I hopped out, began to look for United. There was no United. So I said to the Korean people, I said, where is the United? And they looked at me as I'd come from another world. I wondered for a moment whether I had come from another world. Nobody seemed to know about the United in an international air terminal. An official going by took my arm. He said, come with me. We went downstairs. He said, it's another terminal. I know, I said, I've been there and it's not there. No, he said, this is the domestic terminal. Apparently it had once been the international terminal. So I'd been to International Air Terminal A. I was now in domestic terminal, which had once been an international terminal, and I was to go to a third one. There the United was. There the United was. I had left home in good time because you never know, particularly overseas. There are a few riots in Seoul, as you've seen from the media, although that exaggerates the picture. And you can have all sorts of things happen between when you leave where you're staying and when you arrive at the airport. Accident, breakdowns, riots. So I left in good time, and according to the schedule, the plane was meant to leave for San Francisco at 3:30, but they had up a sign delayed, and I had visions of doors falling off in the Pacific. And, and while I was in Australia, United had one or two troubles with undercarriages as they arrived in Sydney, so I wondered what had gone wrong this time. But 2 hours after the scheduled departure time, I left Korea. I should tell you, in conjunction with this search for the international airport and the right one, the day before I'd set off for Seoul University, and I could not make myself understood to the man at the subway ticket counter until a young man came up and said, oh, yes, yes, and he named the train I was to get. So an hour later, I was at Seoul University, the wrong one. Well, there are three of them. One is the Seoul City University, one is the Seoul National University, and one is the Seoul Women's University. That's the one that's of most interest to men. Men that have no interest in schooling want to go to that university. But I ended up at the wrong university, but enjoyed it very, very much. Beautiful campus. You know, Korea's called the land of the morning calm, the land of the morning calm. And it is a beautiful country, wonderful mountains, hills and valleys and greenery. And the universities I saw, I visited two, are in just beautiful locations. And when you're watching the media picture of the riots in those universities, that is not really representative. That's occasional, because you have to remember there's a lot of infiltration from the north that's come down to the south. Just as when I was in Manila, they told me there were thousands of communist soldiers there without their uniforms on, because communists would gladly make a takeover in the Philippines. So in South Korea, there are many infiltrators from the north, and these stir up uprisings in the universities. But for the most part, it's quite calm and very beautiful indeed. Well, it's not easy to catch a plane that's going, but what's more disconcerting is when you're on time and you find the plane isn't going. I left North Queensland before dawn a few days earlier, and took two different planes, travelled 1,000 miles to get to Brisbane, travelled another 600 miles to get to Sydney, making sure I'd be there in good time. My plane was due to fly out about 1 o'clock, so I was there at 11:45, which is supposed to give you ample time, even at an international airport. And they looked at my ticket and they said, no such plane. I said, what else can I go on? They said, there's a Philippine airline phone. I said, can you put me on it? They said, no, it's just about to leave. I said, will you put me down for the next one? When is it? They said, 2 days' time. So you see, you've got two problems. You may not arrive to catch a plane that is going, or you may arrive and find the plane's not going. I said, now I am definitely down for the next flight. Yes, they said. So next I called the Philippines, and then I called Jill, and Jill called Canada, who's in contact with friends who can get back to the Philippines, because the two calls were made to the Philippines. Both cases, they were away at medical institutions. So it has all sorts of trauma. Here were people expecting to meet me in a few hours' time. I wasn't going to be there, and I couldn't give them the message because they weren't there to tell. But Jill finally got through to Frank Durianz in Canada, who by a devious route got back and gave the message. So I had two extra days unexpected in Sydney, and on the Friday, I was there 3 hours before the plane was due to go. And when I lined up, they told me I only had a standby. Now you can imagine that by this point of time, I have assured the people in the Philippines via Jill, via Frank Durianz, that yes, I've been delayed, but I will be there ready for a meeting on Friday night. Line it all up. I'll be there. And then they told me when I arrived, you only have a standby. I said, they told me I had a sure seat. No, they said, a standby. Well, you just can't argue with them. They run the plane. I don't know how to fly it. And so I said, when do I find out? They said, in 2 hours' time. So there's 2 hours to meditate, chafe and pray, and then line up. And 5 minutes before that plane was supposed to go out, I got a standby ticket. Of course, the plane didn't go out on time. The plane didn't go out on time, but that's the way it was. So these are some of the happy things. The test one. There are time stresses as you travel. The body is controlled by very strict laws, and one set of laws is known as the biological clock. The body functions best if you're regular. Regular in the hours of eating, regular in the hours of sleeping, regular in most things. I have been regular in my irregularity now for 9 weeks. Very regular. You're eating sometimes at midnight according to what your body is, and you're going to sleep sometimes at midday instead of at night, and all sorts of strange things. It's a 20-hour trip approximately to Australia, the usual way via Hawaii, and I've known what it is to take a meeting after arrival, and you take it through a deep haze, a haze of tobacco, a haze of dream, and you just don't seem with it. It's quite interesting to preach under those conditions. When one goes even from Sydney to Perth, as I have done recurringly in Australia, there's about 3 hours difference there. So when you arrive at Perth and you stand up to preach, it's 2 hours past your bedtime. And that's quite something too. These are some of the issues. When I got to Manila, I began preaching when it was my Australian body time of 10 p.m. Got to bed in the morning. Before I began to preach, they said, you must eat some mangoes. And they had some mangoes cut up for me to eat. Very kind and generous people. In Manila, one-third of the city is slums. 60% of Filipinos are living under the poverty level. That's why crime is very rampant in the Philippines. You have to be very careful about losing things or having things taken as you travel anywhere, not just in the Philippines, but anywhere. You've got to look after your passport. You've got to look after your tickets. You have to look after whatever money you've got or traveler's checks. And then you have to look after your luggage. Time after time, your luggage will not arrive. On several occasions in recent years, my luggage has not arrived. I've known what it is to borrow a coat and a Bible to preach in. Fortunately, I had the rest. But not the luggage. Not the luggage. And that's always a moment of trauma to see whether it arrives. And when you go into the type of motels that I use, which were the cheapest, they would have up signs, we do not guarantee the safety of your property. Leave passports at the desk where you have to pay for it to be cared for, and so on. So I usually took it out with me rather than an extra expense. But you wondered which was best, to risk a pickpocket or to hide it somewhere in your room. But coming back to the physical stresses, one of the things I'm allergic to in travelling, and we all have Achilles heels, I've got a dozen of them at least, one of the things I'm allergic to in travelling is smoke. Tobacco smoke. I had at least 50 hours, not 15, 50 hours in long-distance planes exposed to dense smoke on this trip alone. And I remember on the one plane, a Qantas flight that I got, in Australia it is outlawed, smoking on the local planes. But planes that come from overseas are filled with smoke, and they still smoke when they do the steps of the local route. So I got on one of these planes. I had taken so far about 20 meetings in about 6 different cities, and I was rather tired, and I got on this plane. I could feel the sweep of the smoke, which for me could either lead to headache or laryngitis. And when I got off the plane, I knew things weren't functioning too well. And over the next few days, I had developed laryngitis. Now, I had 20 meetings to go. And it was in just a couple of days, I was to begin a series where I'd be talking all day. When you weren't talking at meetings, you're talking to people. Just to get from the pulpit to the exit was like taking a 100-mile journey because you have so many friends to talk to and speak with. So I was getting laryngitis and had all these meetings coming up. My good friend Ronnie Allen, who is to me in Australia as Roy is here, a very good, trusted friend and a wonderful preacher just as Roy is and a good writer too like Roy. Ronnie Allen said to me, look, he said, if there's going to be a time when you don't speak, it ought to be the first meeting, he said. I said, that's a good idea because you've let yourself out on the plan. He's very, very humble sort of person, self-abnegation. I said, that's a good idea. You take tonight's meeting and I'll take... see if the night makes a difference. So he took that meeting, and I took every other meeting. I didn't miss a meeting except that one. In the mercy of God, just the mercy of God, because I had laryngitis for about 7 days, and some of those days I was speaking pretty well all day. So I would get very close to the mic, so as not to put strain on the vocal cords. When I finished the meetings there in Sydney at midday, I had spoken several hours that day by midday, and I had no voice left by the time I got to the exit. I had managed the benediction. I had managed to talk with people several minutes from the pulpit to the exit, and by then I had no voice. So as I got a lift into the city, I said, "You'll forgive me, but I'm going to shut up because I have a radio meeting tonight, and that radio meeting was meant to go over Asia as well as Australia to millions of homes. It was with sent from 2GB, one of the biggest stations in Australia, but it beamed right out into Asia, many countries in Asia. So I couldn't speak at 1 o'clock." And I knew I was to speak that night. And usually with laryngitis, the one great rule is shut up. That's the one great rule for getting over laryngitis. There's nothing else you can do that'll do the job. But I sort of felt the Lord would make it right. I arrived the time I was supposed to speak. I'd been told to be there. It was 9:15. They told me when I arrived it wouldn't be for another hour. So at 10:30 I went on. By then, my voice was good enough to speak. And Heather Cooper, our secretary out there, who does all the things as office manager that Marion does here, they are both so wonderfully not just second-mile people, but 102-mile people. But Heather listened. She said, couldn't notice a thing. It was quite okay. So that was just the providence of God. That meeting ended at 11 o'clock, and I then walked down to the harbour of the city. I knew I wouldn't sleep after the speaking at that time. So I walked down to the city, looked at the waters of Sydney Harbour, and walked back to my motel, a matter of miles, and slept. Then the next day I was due to speak in near the college, and we had a very large crowd there. I still had some voice problems, but got through that. So these are some of the things that can happen, and that happen to most people as they travel. That's a grey picture I've given you. Now I want to tell you about the overwhelming compensation. The greatest joy as one travels, apart from finding evidence after evidence of the mercy, the kindness, and the providence of God. And that to me is a fresh and vivid experience every time I travel. That the Lord is never more than a breath away, not that far. And that his provision is constant and adequate. That I find a tremendous encouragement every time I travel. But next to that, it's the meeting of people. For example, when we went to New Zealand, and preached in Auckland and Whangarei and Christchurch. The first man I met in New Zealand was a Samoan prince who'd been there some years by the name of Atta. Atta's a man whose face was like the sunrise, absolutely a Christian, kind, generous, thoughtful. He said, "This car is for you and Ron." And so he gave his car to Ron and I, and knew we were going to have appointments. Had to go to Radio Rima. I took the devotions for all the staff of Radio Rima, which is a Christian radio station that's heard over much of New Zealand and is going further afield. They want me to do a series of tapes. They've used our tapes very widely there. So Atta said, this beaming Samoan prince, he said, "Now this car is for you," he said, "you take it." And then I found that he'd also arranged that a video expert should be there with his cameras to do the meetings that we had at Auckland. And people came in, including ministers, to those meetings. We had Polynesians and Melanesians, we had Maoris, we had people of Scottish descent and British descent, and here Atta had set up the paraphernalia. And when I was walking early in the morning, I noticed he was sleeping in the room where we held the meetings. And I asked someone, why was that? And he said, well, he's staying by all that stuff. He's looking after it in his sleep to see that none of it is lifted by people might come in overnight to steal. So here was a man, his whole heart was in the gospel. Even when we left, he was there at the airport to see if we needed anything lifted, carried, you know, anything to help us. That was utter. I stayed with people by the name of Wainwright, just sterling Christian people. He was a man of thorough Christian discipline and courtesy and kindness, and his wife, likewise, was a gracious host, very, very efficient. They were a family that had known all sorts of problems and troubles and sufferings. They'd had one daughter who'd been very, very ill indeed, with tremendous surgery. But everyone in that family had such great courage and such faith in Christ. Just a privilege to be with people like that. I think of Ron Allen again that I've mentioned to you, who is to me in Australia as Roy is here, a brother in Christ and a very good friend. And Ron Allen has a very heavy burden. He's the main pastor. We have several out there for GNU. Australia's a very big country. But Ron Allen carries a very heavy responsibility. He has some health problems growing from the time when he was a wheat lumper in the back country of New South Wales. Has a lot of things to battle with, but he's just a gracious, intelligent, dedicated Christian with a wonderful sense of humour. We walked scores of miles together because between meetings we walked everywhere. Even in the rain we walked with some covering, but we walked. And he has a great sense of humour. I hope this won't sound irreverent, what I now tell you. If you knew the whole story, you'd understand and forgive. But we're going down one road, this time driving. And he said, Des, what would you do if you were asked to say a few words at the funeral of so-and-so? Now, the so-and-so to who he referred was a man we both respected for many things, but who was noted for his persecution of gospel ministers. So here's Ronnie saying to me, what would you do if you were asked to say a few words at the funeral of so-and-so? And I said, well, I'd first remember what Dr. Froom said, that some problems can only be solved by funerals. He said, yes, but what are you going to say? See? And so I made a few suggestions. Then I said, what would you say? He said, well, I would say, my dear brethren and sisters, I want you today to remember that every black cloud has a silver lining. But Ronnie Allen, a very gracious, loving person, and he'd have been the first one to give this man a drink of cold water or to carry his port or anything he could have done to help him. But he was just being humorous with someone that wasn't vicious but just misunderstood the issues and consequently had persecuted quite a number of good gospel men. Well, that was Ron. I think of a lady with whom I stayed, who was a justice of the peace. Often policemen would come at night and disturb her to get assigned things. And this poor lady often had constant migraines, constant headaches, but you'd never know. She was the most gracious hostess. Her husband was an ex-soldier, very spiritual man, always thinking on gospel themes. I used to walk with him. But such marvellous people. I think of a couple of pensioners in Adelaide with whom I stayed, both of whom had health problems, but they just put themselves so much out to help and to serve. They lived right on a busy road. I stayed with them the previous year and I was awake each night right through. They were used for traffic. But no one could have been kinder than they were. They once took me, when they knew I had a day free, to the Barossa Valley, which is a place inhabited by Germans who a century before had come and started up wineries. So all around the place were these wine fields, grape fields, and Lutheran churches. Grapes and Lutheran churches, everywhere through the Barossa Valley. And these kind people took me there. I think in Melbourne, where we had over 150 people, the best meetings we'd had in Melbourne for some years, very intelligent folks, sophisticated business people, for the most part, very, very bright. And I had told the story of how in the previous city I'd met an ex-student of mine, and what had worried me more than anything on the trip was that he'd told me, this ex-student, whom I'd known when he was a boy of 15, encouraged to come to college and taught for 4 years, when he'd looked at me, this one that I thought of still as a youngster, and he said, you know what? He said, I'm a grandfather. So I told this story at Melbourne. I said, but it's worse almost when I come here and I see some former students with grey hair. I said, I've got it, but to see my student with it, that's disturbing. When I went out, there was a lady, a well-preserved woman that looked to me perhaps in her early 60s. She said, you're not that old. I said, I'm in my 60s. She looked at me again. She said, how old do you think I am? I said, maybe 60 or so. She said, I'm 80 and I've got a daughter your age. You're just a boy. That was good, wasn't it? I said, what's done it for you? She said, I'm always asking questions. She had an active mind. I could tell you so much about people. In one country, there was a Roman Catholic attorney. He came to the meetings. He said, I've learnt so much. He said, now, next time you come, you must let me know. He said, I'll advertise on television. I'll advertise on radio. We'll get you a better quality hall. I said, how many people do you think you can get out? He said, 1,000. I said, I doubt it, but it sounds good. 1,000. He was so kind and gracious. I had had a very short night after about 8 hours of talking the previous day, and I just had a morning of a three-hour session, the last session, and he looked at me, he said, you need a rest, he said. So he took me into a nearby institution that was well known to many, and we went through room after room, and then he came to a room that was empty, and he pointed to a doctor's couch. He said, that's for you. That's for you. Then he went out and brought back a pillow. He said, here. And he went out and shut the door. And I often rest in the day, but I very rarely sleep. But I just lay down on this couch, this doctor's couch, and I went out like that, like a light. The kindness, the thoughtfulness of this Roman Catholic gentleman. And this is one of the great joys of travel, that you meet so many, many wonderful people. And, of course, for me, it's always a joy to be with my family. I take some days of holiday in between meetings. I stay with my brother and sister-in-law who live near Brisbane, and they live by the water, and I would swim three times a day, and they were just so kind and so thoughtful. My brother's a real character. He's sometimes as wise as Solomon, sometimes as funny as a circus, and times past has often been as drunk as a lord. But he has a very, very kind heart. He went through World War II, and it was rather devastating to him, but a very, very kind person. And I noticed in the room where they had put me, they did everything to make me feel at home. I noticed on the top of a ledge there that there were razors, scissors, pens, pencils, batteries, and all sorts of bits and pieces. And I wondered, what is this collection for? And then I saw a note. Des, here's Flotsam and Jetsam. If it's no use, you just sweep it on the floor. He said, but help yourself. So there was provision in case I'd forgotten razors or pens or batteries, but everything there. When I stayed with my daughter, she disappeared for an hour one day and came back with a new pair of shoes. She knew I had difficulty getting shoes, and the type of shoes I that are wide enough and that will stand up to a fair bit of walking cost about $250 in Australia. And so she disappeared one morning, came back with another pair. I said, I don't need those. You bought me a pair a couple of years ago. She said, this is in case they are not available in a couple of years' time. And that sort of kindness, you expect it perhaps from your own, but it's always very gracious. When I was with my boy, who has a nursery in the north, he said, if you retire, he says, I'm going to build a home so many miles from here. He says, you can have it. He said, it'll be rent-free if you want it. I couldn't give him a guarantee of ever retiring, but I thought it was a gracious type of thing. So it's the kindness of people. One man that I work with there is a man who employs 2,000 people for the main church in Australia. That's Dr. Gordon Moyes. He's a supervisor there for the Uniting Church, which links the Congregational and the Methodist and others. And he introduced a television program. I was on with him in television one night and with him on radio another night. And he introduced the television by saying, I have known Dr. Ford for many years, he says, and long before I met him, I used to read his articles in a magazine called The Signs of the Times. And I used to always think that this guy must now be about 80, he says, but I've met him and he's not 80. So he was a man who, from a boy, had read materials that I used to publish from the early 1950s, and now he was a man in charge of 2,000 workers in the Australian church field. And due to him, I was on television, and a little later on radio. I had got crossed messages about when I was to go on radio with him while I was in another city, so I thought, I wish I could straighten these out so I don't have to be in one place unnecessarily. So I thought, how can I find out? It was night time. The office would be shut. So I said, I know this man has a mission. I remember from boyhood, I used to see this great Wesley mission that people would flood into, a big building. I thought, I wonder if it still operates. I found it. It was another place. I stumbled on it. And I knew I wasn't dressed very well. I was dressed just for walking around. You had to preserve your clothes. You know, I travel so that I can carry all I've got a few miles if I have to. See, everything. And I had enough stuff for 9 weeks. And so I travelled pretty simply in ordinary clothes when I didn't have to be dressed up for meetings. So I thought, I can't go in like that. So I might meet somebody. So I went back to the hotel where I was staying. I had a little room there. You couldn't swing a cat in, but it was adequate. It could fit a bed into it. And I changed, And I went back to this hall, and I thought, now I've got to find someone, ask them whether Dr. Moyes is here tonight. And then I listened, and it was him speaking. I thought, that's his voice. Now I thought, what'll I do? I've got to catch him, and if he's like American preachers, he'll disappear out the back when he's through, and he won't come through the front. So I thought, I've got to go down and sit near to him, so that as soon as he gives the benediction, I can grab him and say, hey, when am I supposed to speak with you? See? And so I was now in my suit, and I went down to near the front, and when he finished, he suddenly said, I see a friend here, and I want to ask Dr. Desmond Ford if he'll come up the front. So he brought me up the front. This is a great crowd of many hundreds of people, see, in this great auditorium. He said, I want to introduce you to Dr. Desmond Ford. And then he spoke very nicely for a few minutes. But this is typical of the providences and the mercies, the courtesy and the kindnesses of people. I remember in Japan last time when I was there, I've only been to Japan once, but the time I was there, I was lost in a station. And you've got to remember, my brother claims that he can get lost in a phone booth, but it's more true of his brother. I can get lost in the wardrobe. You ever read C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? I'm the wardrobe. But in Japan, I was lost in the station, and they're huge places. So I stopped a businessman coming toward me and named the place I wanted to go to. He took my port out of my hand, turned about, motioned me to follow him, and he walked maybe 100 metres or so to an office, spoke in Japanese, and then when he knew I was right and had all the directions, he bowed and went on. This time in Korea, you see, I had to stop at Korea on the way back from the Philippines. So I said to Jill, it's foolish to land down there and not see a little of Korea. I'll say one full day there as well as the day I arrive and the day I leave. So I'll stay in Korea and just have a look around. I asked a friend if there were any gospel people there that we could have a meeting, but no one seemed to know anyone. I said, I'll go and look at it anyway. It'll be education. And in Korea, the subway system is as in other cities where you often have to change trains without going out of the station to go in some other direction. So I was doing this, but there are some technicalities that at times make it rather difficult because no English signs there. While in the Philippines, almost everybody spoke English. That was not true in Korea. You just see these weird and wonderful alphabetical signs that look like modern art. So I got out of the train. I knew I had to change. So I looked at, again, a young man who was obviously an employee of the subway, and I said, do you know English? He said, a little. He said, I was guiding around Englishmen for the last Olympics. And so I explained what I wanted. He said, where do you come from? Australia. Oh, he said, I was with Australians at the last Olympics, guiding them. He said, what do you do? I said, I'm minister of the gospel. He said, so am I. He said, I've got two jobs. He says, I work for the subway by day and I'm a minister at night. Yeah. So this was the type of thing that one ran into. When I went to Incheon, which is one of the four main cities of Korea, Incheon I knew was only 1 hour away. And the subway system's very cheap. It only cost me, apart from the accommodation at the YMCA, it cost me no more than $20 while I was in Korea. That covered food and what travelling I had to do. I knew that I could get to Incheon for a dollar. So I travelled to Incheon by subway. It was the last place. But when I got out, I said to myself, now this is one of the four main cities of Korea. This is a country of about 50 to 60 million people. And what I want to do, I want to see where the invasion spot was, where MacArthur came in. You know, he came in via Incheon and then took Seoul and thus saved South Korea. And I would also like to see the commemoration park where they have a big statue of MacArthur. You know, the Lord is so merciful. He doesn't only give us the necessities. He often gives us the luxuries. And I thought, how will I manage this? No one around here perhaps will speak English. There are no English signs. I've got no idea where to go. So since I got out of the station, I looked around and I took the biggest hill I could find. I thought, from up there, I may see something. So I went up this hill. And I can't explain to you now what happened. Maybe someone here can explain it to me after service. But as I got up near the hill, I noticed there was a park up there, and there were Korean people walking up backwards to it. Everywhere around, people were walking up backwards. So it must have some ceremonial religious significance. But as the Gladys was saying, some type of shrine. And they were walking up backwards reverentially, you see, the shrine. So I hit the park and I can suddenly see the sea, and I now know where MacArthur came in. I'd love to see the statue of MacArthur. It's supposed to be somewhere in this great city. And you know what? Within 30 seconds, I saw the peaked cap way up in the heights, and it was the statue of MacArthur. Within 3 minutes, I was looking at it and reading the commemoration to the genius and the courage of this great American general. So, you know, it's one of those things you could live without, but the Lord is very merciful. He gives us not only the things that are necessary for life and godliness, but he fulfills many of our minor wishes along the way. When I came back, I got lost as usual and stopped a policeman and said, because I'd come down the park from another direction, stopped a policeman and said, station, station. Now, he misunderstood me, so I saw him heading for a taxi. The flag went up immediately, so I tapped my legs. I said, no. I want to walk there. So he said, so many meters, and pointed the direction, and thus another financial catastrophe was averted. Yeah. Travel is a matter of constant exigencies and emergencies, and it teaches constant weakness. Constant weakness. You know, bacteria I couldn't see gave me laryngitis. And none of us are very strong. Not any of us. Travel teaches constant weakness and therefore constant dependence. And that's the only healthy state for a Christian. If you're not constantly dependent, you're not living in a Christian way. If you think you're equal to things, no one is. No one is. Any modern car can disprove your thesis in a moment. I remember when I was moving around some of the back alleys in Seoul, I wanted to see some of the more unusual institutions there as well as the usual from the outside at least. And so I was moving around some of the back alleys in Seoul and coming to a corner, and I thought I could hear something, and suddenly a motorbike came round and he had to run me down by the mercies of God. Of course, he wasn't going very fast, fortunately, but there was no room to dodge. These were very narrow lanes. I couldn't help but hit him. So I lurched over and grabbed his handlebars, and I must have straddled it or something, but there'd have been no more jogging for several months. But for the mercies of God. So there are all these exigencies that are ever with one. And it's a good thing, because we're told to live by faith alone. And that means trusting God where you can't trace him. I've mentioned to you many of the wonderful people and their kindness. One man some of you know about was Harold Spearing. He was a sweet gospel poet that wrote that poem, Within the Veil. Some of you have seen it. Within the Veil. We had it at our last Congress. He was dying of cancer. So Ron Allen and I travelled hours to go up and see him. And he was perfectly trusting in God. He suspected that his end was very near. But there wasn't a complaint. Not a complaint. He thanked us very graciously for coming to see him. We stayed, talked with him, prayed with him, and left. And a day later he was gone. And by then I was in Perth. And the country I had left, Queensland, was flooded. Within 24 hours of my leaving Queensland, cities were surrounded by water. The whole place was flooded. I'm not sure whether I could have gotten out. And I saw it on the news from 3,000 miles away. And Ron Allen called me to say that Harold Spearing was died. And one might ask the question, why is it that the Christians do have to go through trauma, like this man Harold Spearing? He'd been sick for quite some time. Why even such common things as travelling? Why isn't it easier for Christians? The answer's obvious, isn't it? If to be a Christian meant that everything was simple, that all your problems were immediately solved, that every prayer was answered yes immediately, you know what? The church would be flooded with hypocrites. See? So it is in the mercy of God and in the wisdom of God that Christians too must negotiate shoals and hard things. He whom thou lovest is sick. That's still true. Ron and Alan and I talked quite a bit on the nature of the Christian ministry. And we talked about this passage in 2 Corinthians 4. We're afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not driven to despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying in the body the death of Jesus, so the life of Jesus might be manifested in our bodies. Let me give you a summing up of what happened before we close. We had meetings first in New Zealand, in the chief cities there. Met many marvellous people. From there, we went to Australia, where I spoke at Palm Beach, the so-called Gold Coast. Then I flew 3,000 miles to Perth. We had a congress there, wonderful people, kindly people, good people. And that it was by the sea. I remember before dawn going down and swimming in the rain off Perth's coast. From there to Adelaide, where we had another congress. Neville McKenzie, one of our ministers there, a gospel GNU minister, joined me there. He's a very fine man. His wife is a beautiful song leader. And we had wonderful meetings in Adelaide. from there to Melbourne, which was the best congress we'd had, about 150 and very, very important people. You know, we had doctors, quite a number of professional people, and they're all precious, but some have more influence than others. And these were people that were very influential. From there to Sydney, a congress in Sydney. From there, a congress in Brisbane. In between, meetings near the college, a meeting at the college, near to the college at Skurumbong, Morisset area. Then after meetings in Brisbane, I flew up to Rockhampton, a college of advanced education, where we had the biggest group we'd had for years there. Fine group. One of them wanted to talk to me further. So he was at our home next morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, and we walked for miles together and talked. From there, I spent one day and part of another with my son at Gladstone, then back to Sydney, and ultimately flew out to Manila. When you think of places like the Philippines, you need to remember that nearly 50% die before the age of 5. It's something like 41.3% die before the age of 5. In Western countries like America, you have out of every 1,000 people about 200 under the age of 15 and about 122 over the age of 65. That's America. 200 out of every 1,000 under the age of 15, 122 over the age of 55. In a place like the Philippines, it's between 300 and 400 under the age of 15 and about 50 over the age of 65. The average Filipino lives 15 years less than the average American. Can you get that? 15 years less. 60 to 70 of the preschoolers suffer from malnutrition in the Philippines. Now that affects them emotionally, it affects them spiritually, affects them character-wise. 60 to 70%. One third of Manila is slums. Last Sabbath I preached in Quezon City, which is really a suburb of Manila. We had to go through mud to get there, along planks. We not only walked on planks, we then sat on planks in a church that had just fabric for walls and corrugated iron for roof. There was no what they called a comfort room. There was no comfort room. No toilets there. They hoped to take in enough money in coming months so they would be able to build a comfort room. And we sat on planks about 20 feet long, about 6 inches broad or deep. Not like these. Not like these. Can you imagine being for hours on planks, hard wooden planks, 6 inches, you know? And I took the Sabbath school lesson and took the church service. And then we went back to have a 3-hour meeting in the afternoon. And we had doctors and people like architects, lawyers. We had some of the leading people of a number of the churches come out for those meetings. People were very hospitable. They wanted me to go and stay in different homes. So even after I'd had about 8 hours of speaking with people, and it was now about 9:30 at night, they said we had to go through the city because people wanted to have me at another home. So at 9:30 at night, we set off on an hour's trip right across Manila. And let me tell you, it's an adventure driving in Manila. It's an adventure driving in Manila. One of the most constant miracles I ever see in the third world countries is the fact there aren't more accidents. It is just amazing. It is just amazing. I was talking to an American coming home on one of the flights, and he said, we hired a car, he said, for 3 days after the first day I returned it. And I understand that. And Manila is polluted with haze you can see. Seoul is polluted with so much pollution you can hardly see the sun. You think you could look at it without danger, but that would be foolish. But it's so covered with haze. But in Seoul it's different. They must be on unleaded petrol. They're very different, Manila and Korea. Japan took over Korea in 1910. They industrialized it, and technology became the rule until it was made free about 1945. But Korea is prosperous. Technology is at its height. The people are healthy. The policemen are neat and trim. I never saw one policeman whose stomach was bulging over his belt. And, you know, it worries me in some countries when I see policemen like that, because I think, how could they ever chase someone who's chasing me?